Say good morning. Good morning. Welcome, everyone who's just dialed in. It's 10:10. It's time for Coffee with the Coder, episode 56. Thank you all for joining in, and also a special thanks to our insiders who dialed in at 10 o'clock this morning. Yay, Paula, I'm ready to get started. Are you?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, I loved absolutely. What you said at 10 o'clock. So maybe if the people who are not insiders and would like to be, there's two ways. One way is you can just dial in at 10 minutes before the call starts and you hear everything. The other is you can submit your mugshot, which is a picture of you with something AQIQ branded, so a selfie with AQIQ in it, to our Facebook page, or you can email it to me. We want to use it on social media and on our website, and that's called your mugshot. And that gets you, that's the price of admission to the insider's page on Facebook. So anyway, let me start right quick. We're going to go to Amanda, who is writing in from an inpatient rehab, and I'm going to give out this scenario and see what she's asking. If a patient is admitted for quadriplegia as a late effect of a TBI, would the patient go in O2 or O4? Going by the title of each IGC, it would make the most sense to place the patient in a TBI IGC, but the guidance under IGC 4 says includes cases with various forms of quadriplegia and paraplegia regardless of etiology, whether non-traumatic, such as medical or postoperative, codes 4.110 through 4.130, or traumatic, codes 4.210 through 4.230. Makes me wonder if the patient should go in 4.220.
Okay. Yeah, and Amanda and I had had a few email exchanges, and we hadn't really got a chance to talk about it. So, Amanda, I hope you're on the call today. When selecting the IGC, of course, there's a couple of things we have to, determine. The underlying reason for the focus of care of why the patient is coming to rehab. So what is that primary focus of care? And I want to say primary because that is key in this. And you have to ask yourself the question, what is the underlying reason and what's the primary focus of care? It sounds like, based on your scenario, I could make a very strong argument. It sounds like the focus of care here is the quadriplegia, not the brain. However, here's my questions I'm going to start asking. Is this a true quadriplegia with cord involvement, or is there something else going on where the patient that causes just a short-term type paralysis where the physician is calling it, quad, and they're treating it as part of the care for the brain injury? So you really have to look at, that true underlying cause and the focus of care. Do both of those conditions, is there a quad, caused from this TBI? And do both conditions cause the need for care equally? Another question, of course, you want to ask yourself, and this is one of those ones near and dear to my heart, is the physician saying everything? Did he leave something off? Was there really actually a cord injury as well? So without seeing the documentation, I can't really say, yes, we're going to go this way or we're going to go that way. But I can, cue you to ask some more questions. And then, and Amanda and I talk, I know we've talked recently, and she's sent emails. So just like the rest of you guys, send those emails in so we can have those discussions about your question as well. Quadriplegia, though, just to let you guys know, you might be going, wow, really, quadriplegia caused by a brain injury? It can be caused by a brain injury. More often, it is a, spinal cord injury, a traumatic injury that causes that. But quadriplegia can be caused, in some cases, by a brain injury. And we want to know if it is a documentation issue, if the document, if the physician is saying it clearly, or if there's something more. So I'd like to ask Amanda if you can, if we can go back and forth with some more emails, and then maybe I can update you guys on Coffee with the Coder, what we determined. But that was, had questions in answering that question wholly. So Pam?
Thank you, Amanda. You're in the running for the mug today. And the next question, someone who's in the running for the mug today, is Dawn. I can't tell what type of facility she's writing from, but or provider. So let me just give you the question, and maybe you will know by the question. Our physician is hesitant to code critical illness myopathy even if it's stated by the acute hospital physician, unless he has an EMG to support it. Is that a requirement? I understand that there should also be supporting documentation for definite weakness and so forth, requiring the need for therapy and, oh, inpatient rehab.
Yeah, there you go. I was going to say, Pam, that's okay. Inpatient rehab question. Yeah, and we get this question. There's always a lot of confusion around critical illness myopathy. And so thanks for asking your question. So I'm going to do something a little bit different, Dawn, because you asked this question and you cued others. I'm going to give everybody on the call today a special deal on a webinar that we did for critical illness myopathy. That's in addition to the other stuff we are giving away today. So if you're on the call and you want to view this webinar and you are not already a subscriber to AQIQ, put in the code CIM, critical illness myopathy, CIM info, all together, CIMINFO, when you order, and you'll get this webinar for $20. So we have, again, so many discussions about this diagnosis. I wanted to give you guys all the ability to get some extra detailed information on it. And Dawn, because you asked the question, you get an extra $10 off. So, hey, guys, send in those questions because it pays off, right? So, Dawn, you'll get it for $10, and if you'll reach out to Pam, she will give you access to that and give you a code as to how to enter that when you're purchasing. This is going to end midnight Friday, so if you don't get it before midnight Friday this week, you won't be able to get it. So back to the question. There are really mixed thoughts that I have seen in the industry and talking to different physicians about diagnosing critical illness myopathy with or without, well, actually without, not with, an EMG or a muscle biopsy. Many physicians, you know, want to stay on the safe side. And while, you know, many other physicians say, well, yeah, I can tell just by the patient presentation and what's going on, this is absolutely a critical illness myopathy. So it's just like when the physician would document other diseases. I have not seen any requirement in regulatory guidance or by CMS that said you have to have an EMG or you have to have a muscle biopsy. I have seen recommendations that it could be part of it. And then in some of the details that I'm going to share with you, I've got four documents that we downloaded, two from the National Institute of Health, one from the CDC, and one from the American Association of PM&R Docs that will be attached to this call when we have it on the AQIQ site. So that said, you can review those documents. There's a lot of great information about critical illness myopathy. Of course, as you said, there are certain symptoms a patient with CIM presents with, and you know, there's many physicians that don't want to say it's critical illness if it's not stated in the acute, or even if it is stated in the acute, like your physician, without the specific test. Now, it's perfectly fine, though, on the other hand, the flip side of that, for a rehab physician to call it even if it's not called in the previous acute. But let me warn you, the clinical documentation evidence must back it up. So I wanted to take a moment to go through some of the things that you might see in the record that lead to the diagnosis of CIM. You might see an ICU or a CCU stay for 6 or more days. Patient may have been on a vent and weaned within the past 3 or 4 days, maybe with difficulty weaning. There might be a current or recent use of antiarrhythmics, vasoactive meds, or thrombolytics, and there might have been recent or current need for blood products. Typically, these patients are coming in, they're, you know, previously had sepsis or some other, they could have even been a trauma-type situation. They might have had, you know, SIRS with organ dysfunction. Symptoms include, for CIM, include a preserved sensory nerves, decreased reflexes, muscle weakness with proximal more pronounced than distal, muscle atrophy, increased, or it might be normal, creatinine kinase or CK levels, difficulty raising from a chair, bed, floor, or the tub. There's also a component of a more generalized weakness, but you can't just go with the patient having generalized weakness and say it's critical illness myopathy. Muscles are unexcitable from direct stimulation. Weakness of the respiratory muscles, perhaps causing difficulty breathing. You might see a patient newly on oxygen. Some of the clinical indicators that I mentioned is, you know, include sepsis, multi-organ failure, respiratory failure, organ transplant patients, patients that had difficulty of weaning off ventilator, prolonged immobility, high doses or long-term steroid treatment, and like I said, even trauma. Now, according to the CDC, testing to validate critical illness myopathy may include things like an MRI of the C-spine, nerve conduction studies and EMGs, repetitive stimulation, phrenic nerve studies, creatinine kinase and aldolase, as well as muscle biopsy. So it's not only the EMG and the muscle biopsy, there's other tests that can be performed as well. So again, that's going to go back to the physician's, you know, clinical decision making. But just remember, a critical illness myopathy is not the only diagnosis that we have issues with in this category. So you've got critical illness polyneuropathy, and in what I've read and putting in these documents for you to read that I won't give you the links to, but they will be attached to the recording of this. They indicate that in many, many cases, critical illness polyneuropathy is associated at the same time with patients who have critical illness myopathy. But the physician may say CHF myopathy, COPD or steroid myopathy, uremic myopathy, disuse myopathy, critical illness polyneuropathy, you know, and the clinical indicators differ based on what condition the patient actually has. So, Pam, I just wanted to give a little more information than the question was asking on that one, because I think we have so much discussion about it.
Absolutely, and thank you. Do you think we have time to squeeze in one more? This one doesn't look very
good. Yeah, it looks like a short question, so go ahead.
Okay, so this is from Anonymous, and they sent it through our website, through the Coffee with Dakota submission form. For inpatient rehab coding, would a fracture and a mobility-impairing contusion be considered for impairment group 14.9? For example, a fracture of the right humerus bone with a contusion of the left thigh and severe pain in the left thigh?
Good question. I would ask, first of all, back to like we talked about in that other question, does the documentation suggest that one is primary focus of care or that both are equally weighted? So is the problem on the thigh, the contusion on the thigh, is it so impairing that truly the patient, you know, is having extreme difficulty walking where you've got an upper and a lower extremity issue, right? But they're not both fractures. The impairment is the primary cause of the debility. One may be actually secondary, but if they're both the same, then I could see an argument for the 14.9. However, if the fracture was primary, then you're going to go more for the 8.9. Or if the contusion was primary with the other as a comorbidity, I'm going to go to 8.9. But you'd have to really evaluate the documentation and see what is the primary focus of care, and then determine, you know, which route you go, whether it's multiple. Because we had multiple body systems, that's why I would allow you've got the musculoskeletal, the muscle, so to speak, and the bones, even though it's both musculoskeletal, I would consider the 14.9. But again, dig in that documentation, make sure that one is not primary and the other is a comorbidity of it.
Thank you, thank you. And we appreciate all those questions. We just love questions here. So I know we don't have time to do all the questions on any given episode, but it is so wonderful to get them in and send our auditors out there searching for answers. So thank you for sending them in. Send them more. We love the questions. And I want to remind everybody before I give away the mug today about our All Access February deal. So it's We Heart You February. The entire library for our Coffee with Dakota listeners for only $50. Instead of paying $50 or more for each course, you can get the whole library for the entire month of February for $50. So you just need to reach out to me on social media or email, whatever, and I'll make that available to you. And then it's the entire library. So almost 200. It's up there really close. There's also a reminder that the Revenue Warriors is opening up soon, and if you're not already on the wait list, you want to go on there. And there's the other reminder that Erfro Labs would like to consider your facility if you're in an inpatient rehab facility or if you have access to that type of classroom type venue. That's the word I was looking for. Then reach out to us because we are eager to get that done. And let me see. Okay, so who is the winner today? I've just been stirring these two non-anonymous names together underneath my desk. And today's mugging goes to Amanda, Thank you, Amanda, for that question, and thank you, Dawn, for the question. Thank you, everybody, for the question. We are excited that you came today, and for the replay on the website. We'll see you in 2 weeks for Coffee with Decoder, episode 57.